Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Today's show might just challenge everything you thought you knew about health and longevity. Our next guest is Dr. Robert Lufkin, here to talk about his groundbreaking new book, Lies I Taught in Medical School. He'll reveal some shocking truths about modern medicine's approach to chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. Unfortunately, it turns out that standard medical advice might be doing more harm than good. Dr. Lufkin will share practical strategies to help prevent and even reverse these chronic conditions. Stay tuned for some life-saving tips to help you reclaim your health. Don't go anywhere. It all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Our next guest is a leading expert in metabolic health and longevity. He's a practicing physician, professor at UCLA and USC medical schools, and he's the author of more than 200 peer-reviewed scientific papers and 13 books. He also hosts the popular Health Longevity Secrets podcast. After facing a life-threatening health crisis, Dr. Lufkin embarked on a journey that challenged his medical knowledge and led to revelations about metabolic misinformation. His mission now is to expose these truths and help others achieve better health and longevity. His new groundbreaking book is called Lies I Taught in Medical School. Welcome to the show, Dr. Robert Lufkin.
Oh, thanks, David. I'm a fan of the program, and it's a pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you.
That's great. So great to have you on the show. Now, I'm almost done reading your new book. I must say, you've done an incredible job of debunking common medical and health myths out there, and kudos to you. Share with us, you know, with the listeners, what inspired you to write this book and challenge conventional medical wisdom?
Well, I have to say, I'm not really a conspiracy theorist. I'm pretty much an establishment doctor. I spent my entire career basically at medical schools as a professor, and I see patients. So I'm really part of the establishment. What really caused me to question the beliefs that I had and that some of my colleagues are still teaching was I came down with four chronic diseases, as many people do in the sort of midpoint in their lives. And I was told to put on prescription. I was put on prescription medicines that I was told I would take for the rest of my life. And the doctors told me there wasn't really many options. And I, knowing what I knew about medicine, this wasn't going to end well. I still had young daughters at the time, and I wanted to see if there were other options. And I began looking at the latest scientific research and realized that there have been a lot of breakthroughs that I wasn't aware of, and many of my colleagues still weren't aware of. And I applied those to my own situation and was able to actually reverse those diseases. And the idea of this book is I want to make this information available to other people, everyone, so other people don't make the same mistake I did and know there are other options out there other than a lifetime of prescription medicines.
Yeah, you pretty much hit them all the biggies. The big one out there, of course, is heart disease, the leading cause of death. And in your book, you challenge some widely held beliefs. And one of the key points you make is that high blood pressure is not best treated with drugs. Can you explain why?
Yeah, great question. One of the diseases I came down with was high blood pressure. And I'm in good company. Most adult Americans, over half, have this hypertension, as it's called. And like everyone else, I believe that you take these prescription medicines, they lower your blood pressure, they get rid of the symptoms and lower the blood pressure. And I thought the underlying disease was being managed, but I realized it really wasn't. Like almost all of these chronic diseases that I talk about in the book, whether it's, you know, heart attack, stroke, cancer, Alzheimer's, obesity, diabetes, the medicines that we get from the current healthcare system do manage the symptoms and in some cases may save our lives, but the problem is they don't address the underlying what's called root causes. And for hypertension, I mean, it's the same root cause for most of these diseases, in my opinion. And for hypertension, what I was doing, I was taking the pills, I was lowering my blood pressure, but meanwhile, the damage to my blood vessels was continuing to progress. So instead of doing that, I opted for addressing the root cause with metabolic lifestyle changes. And I was able to get off the hypertension medicines. I no longer need them. And indeed, all the other medicines I was on.
Yeah, interesting. I know one of the first pieces of advice that doctors give to patients diagnosed with hypertension is cut out salt, get it away. But in your book, you suggest that might not be the best approach. Share why.
That's the advice I was given too. And the kidneys work by, you know, controlling the salt concentration. But if you think about it, throughout our history, salt has been used as the major preservative of food up until refrigeration came into play, 100 years ago or so. If you think about it, our ancestors ate a lot more salt than we did just as a normal part of their diet, yet they didn't have problems with hypertension. So this epidemic of hypertension, just like the epidemic of all these chronic diseases, is really a new phenomenon in the 21st century. And what we're discovering is that the driver for hypertension is not so much salt, but it's linked to the same root causes, which are tied to things like fructose, sugar, and the metabolism of these products involving chemicals like urate and then ultimately nitric oxide, which controls our vascular endothelium, which is how our blood vessels work and control blood pressure. So it's really fascinating now that we're understanding that things like fructose can influence not only diabetes and insulin resistance and all these chronic diseases, but also can drive blood pressure.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting because our body's made of mostly salt water. So how can it be bad when we cry our tears are salty? We're made out of salt. So it always befuddled me, why is salt bad? But there are good salts and bad salts, right? Correct. There's Himalayan, Celtic, black lava salt. Is there one in particular that we're okay with versus the white table salt?
I don't have a favorite on those particular ones. I'm pretty much agnostic. As long as there's not additives to the salt, we want to make sure we're getting a pure form with nothing added to it. So that's kind of what I look for.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know years ago, 140 over 90 was considered normal blood pressure, but now the desired threshold is 120 over 80. What is the ideal blood pressure? It's going to keep changing. Now it's going to be 110 over 70. When should we be concerned?
The thing about blood pressure is, like some of the other chronic diseases, but not all of them, blood pressure is a silent disease. In other words, it doesn't have a lot of symptoms. So high blood pressure, we may not notice it. You know, occasionally people may get headaches or they may not. But the problem is high blood pressure damages our kidneys, damages our blood vessels, and basically does a lot of harm before we're even aware of it. So it's very important to get blood pressure checked when you go in to see your healthcare provider. They always check your blood pressure. You can even go into CVS and have it checked on machines there. So the important thing is that it is asymptomatic. 120 over 80 is probably a good number. And, you know, I think it's going to stay there. It should stay there, even with the increasing average blood pressure, because more and more people are coming down with this hypertension due to a lot of environmental factors that drive all these chronic diseases. But I think 120 over 80 is a good number to hit.
I see, many people, they're turning to these herbal and nitric oxide supplements instead of high blood pressure meds. Do any of these supplements get your seal of approval? Do you like any of these?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that particular contain beet extracts, beet juice and all certainly work. In writing this book, one thing I wasn't aware of as far as blood pressure is that the nitric oxide, which is the good chemical that helps our blood vessels dilate, helps control hypertension and also mental conditions and also the immune function. This nitric oxide is produced in our mouth with certain types of bacteria. And when we take mouthwash that kills the bacteria, it can harm the production of nitric oxide. So there's some interesting studies, correlative studies, that show that people who use mouthwash are more likely to have hypertension, high blood pressure, than people who don't. And for that reason, I stopped taking mouthwash and I don't recommend it. You know, it's important to keep our teeth clean by brushing, flossing, that sort of thing. But mouthwash, which the new antibacterial ones kill the bacteria, microorganisms in the mouth, I don't recommend that because it can drive blood pressure because of its effect on nitric oxide and have other untoward effects as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because my father was doing Listerine. I walked in and says, "Whoa, that's killing." He says, "That's not good." I go, "No, it's destroying your microbiome and his gut." It's something, like you said, there's so many cascade, not just blood pressure. But one thing you mentioned in your book that I was happy to see, because my next book is going to be on it, is environmental pollutants. You mentioned how these can affect hypertension as well. How can toxins that we're exposed to affect our blood pressure?
Yeah, I mean, air pollution, certainly smoke. People think about cigarettes and cancer and, everyone's a lot of people are happy. Well, I vape now, but there's no tobacco in it. It's just, you know, a neutral thing. But actually, the vaping itself or any kind of smoking, the particulate matter from that, or increasingly, if you live in an urban environment, you're near a highway, these high air pollution factors, these particulates actually damage the lining of the blood vessels, which contributes to hypertension, contributes to cardiovascular disease, and these can be drivers for Alzheimer's disease as well.
Yeah. I know in your chapter on obesity, there's another lie that you debunk. It says just exercise and eat less. That's what we're told, but that theory doesn't pan out in your opinion. Share why that advice is outdated.
Yeah. I mean, that advice sadly is still being given today by reputable institutions that should know better. You know, you want to lose weight, just exercise more and eat less. Well, of course, we know exercise has many, many benefits to our health, but unfortunately, weight loss is not one of them because when we exercise, our appetite increases, we eat more. And actually, the number of calories we burn during exercise is relatively small. You know, you eat a muffin, it's 500 calories. I have to run 10 miles to account for that. So that's the problem. Then the other one is just eat less is misleading too. In other words, all food is not the same. A calorie is not a calorie, despite what people say today. And we talk about in the group how different food groups, you can eat the same number of calories depending on the food group, you know, fat, protein, or carbohydrates. Depending on the food group you pick, the calories will either go to add fat to your body or they'll go for energy. And so by choosing the food groups, you can actually lose weight by eating the same number of calories.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember running next to somebody down a treadmill and this big guy sweating. He goes, man, I'm going to be earning that donut this afternoon. Like, you can't outrun your diet, right? You can't outrun the fork. So.
Exactly. I wish it was true. But yeah.
Talk to us about genetics. A lot of people blame their weight on genetics and they think if their parents were overweight, it's their destiny. Can we blame our genes on why we can't fit into our genes?
Yeah, that's such an important point. You know, the old saying is, how do you live a long time? Well, the answer is pick your parents right. Well, we're understanding that genetics do play a role in our health, but it's a much smaller role than we thought. You know, for longevity, it's now the thinking between 10 and 20%. But as I mentioned before, we're facing an epidemic of these so-called chronic diseases that represent 80% of our healthcare expenditure and the things we're most likely to die of, things like diabetes, hypertension, cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, and heart attack. And these diseases are exploding. In other words, the numbers of people with these diseases are unprecedented in human history. There are more diabetics now, even accounting for population differences than there have ever been before. So what does that tell you? Well, our genes don't change. In other words, it's the same genes across these, but something else is causing these diseases to explode. So we can't blame it on our genetics, but we have to look for environmental factors. And that's what the book does. We talk about lifestyle and the environmental things that we control and that we get to choose every day that can really help minimize our risk for these diseases or in some cases actually reverse them as well.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I always tell people that, you know, if you can show me a picture of your great grandparents that were overweight, blame them. But you won't, because back in the 1800s and 1900s, if you look at pictures, they were all thin. There was very few obese. We can't blame them, right? It's, you know, I think we can blame lifestyle and habits maybe our parents taught us, but you're right. It's not all about genetics and genes. Otherwise, our great grandparents would have been overweight if we're overweight.
Absolutely.
Stop blaming great grandma. You're not a fan of statins. I'm so glad because I've been hearing so many more patients coming in being prescribed these. And doc, at borderline high levels, like why are they prescribing statins? Even low cholesterol levels. Share with us why that's not a good choice, even for people that have it or even to prevent heart disease.
Yeah, statins are a complicated question. I'm not recommending anyone discontinue their statins or anything without speaking to their healthcare provider. So any decisions you make about statins or any medication you're on should be done with your healthcare provider. But having said that, I think statins have been oversold in their effectiveness. They're predominantly a drug that will lower LDL cholesterol. And the idea is you'll lower your risk of heart attack. And problem is most people who come in from heart attacks have normal LDL cholesterol. So the effect of statins on heart attacks are relatively small. And despite articles touting 30% reduction in heart attacks, the actual number is about 1%. And this is due to some statistical alchemy that people use in reporting these numbers. But wait a minute, if heart disease, as you mentioned, is the number one killer that we're, you know, you and I and all our listeners are most likely to die of, hell, you know, heck, I'll take 1%. Right. I'll take 1% risk on that. But I'll take a 1% risk reduction. But actually, the problem is there are many side effects of statins, which are also minimized, things like muscle pain and even mental conditions, brain fog, suicide. In fact, large studies, which have just come out looking at the cause of mortality of people on statins, it shows a 1% reduction in heart attacks. In other words, people on statins die of fewer heart attacks. But when you look at all-cause mortality in large populations, there's no difference in the people taking statins from the general population. What does that mean? It means that people on statins died of fewer heart attacks, but they died of more other things. What kinds of things? Things like suicides, things like traffic accidents, where these are correlative studies, but it suggests something else is going on when we use statins and lower our LDLs. There may be some other unintended consequences. So I go into a lot of detail on statins in the book, and we just have to look at them closely. And I don't think they're the panacea or the cure-all that we once thought they were.
Yeah, it's like 1%. So you're telling me there's a chance, but yeah, 75% risk of getting the side effects, huh? that might not be good odds there. Hey, if LDL levels aren't the best predictor, is there a better option? What should we look for? Is there a certain test?
Yeah, that was a wake-up call for me that we've been taught that fat cholesterol drives heart disease. And now we're learning, well, there's not so much. There's a bigger player in the room, certainly, and that is this underlying root cause that we talk about in the book that I've referenced, metabolic disease. And that means things like insulin resistance and inflammation, which are indicated by things like triglycerides, HDL, and things like a HOMA IR score. These are much more closely tied to our risk for heart attack than LDL levels. The problem is there's not really a pill for this kind of metabolic health. But the good news is, the metabolic health is addressed with lifestyle, and that's how we can change it. And the great thing about lifestyle is we get to choose every single day.
Yeah, so true. There's a lot of focus I'm hearing on longevity, anti-aging. I was glad you brought that up in the book. What are your views on aging? Is it really possible to turn back the clock? I love that chapter on that in your book.
You know, I didn't think so before I started this journey, but now, you know, another wake-up call for me, a thing I've realized is we're in the middle of the single largest longevity revolution in history. In other words, there are more breakthroughs on longevity now in the last 10 years than there have ever been in all of history. So it's a fact, people are going to be living longer. We're all going to be living longer, hopefully. And it's a good thing. I mean, our fertility rates, our birth rates are dropping in many countries around the world. So getting a few years out of people, productive years out of people, is really important. But the longevity awareness really was something I hadn't known before. And in fact, the second to last chapter of my book is on longevity. And the thing I realized that once we do these lifestyle techniques and we improve, you know, our hypertension, our diabetes, our risk of cancer, our risk of Alzheimer's, once we do all these things, we actually have effects on our longevity, because those are the diseases that determine how long we live, literally, for most people. And if we lower the risk of those or reverse them or push them back, then it increases our longevity for all of us. So it's the same metabolic lifestyle factors that actually improve our longevity that will affect all these diseases. So it's great. The same sort of nutritional choices, the same kind of exercise choices, sleep, stress, things like that have all these amazing effects that so many people, I wasn't aware of it certainly. And I think many people, including my colleagues, are still not aware of it.
Yeah. I know in that chapter, you mentioned a drug called, I believe it's rapamycin, that shows promise for treating age-related chronic diseases and increasing lifespan. I'd never heard of that. Share more with us about this. And it seems the side effects are pretty low.
Yeah. Rapamycin is an amazing drug that was discovered from bacteria on Easter Island, or Rapa Nui. That's how it got its name. But it works on a fundamental switching protein called TOR, T-O-R, or mTOR, which is a metabolic switch, which is the same switch that we act on with our lifestyle and all these choices. It's having the same effect on mTOR as rapamycin is, or similar effects. And rapamycin is, without question, the single most powerful pharmacological intervention to create longevity, increase longevity in animal models, all the way from yeast to flies to worms to mice. Many people are using it now in dogs, and many people are using it as humans and as an off-label use for longevity. I mean, I take rapamycin, but I want to caution people, it's not a replacement for changing your lifestyle and adopting healthy living patterns. In fact, you know, if you want to live a long time, I do, I'm doing both. So rapamycin is not a pill you can do instead of changing your lifestyle. It's something that you could do in addition to it if you choose to do that. It's available by prescription, so you need to talk to your doctor about it. And a lot of doctors aren't even familiar with this application, but it's a really exciting area. And we talk about that a lot in the book as well.
Yeah. I think Keith Richards takes rapamycin, but as you said, his lifestyle's pathetic, and look at his face and tells it. So he's going to live to be 120, but not a healthy man.
Yeah, those guys are amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Hey, talk to us briefly about diet. I know there's so many differences of opinion out there, and you have your beliefs. Is there a specific diet you advocate and follow?
Yeah. I mean, I advocate a metabolically healthy diet, and this is the one that I followed. And of the lifestyle choices we make, I think the choices we make about our nutrition are one of the most powerful ones. And so for my diet, if you want to improve your health without changing what you eat, just change when you eat. The first thing I did was I stopped snacking all the time, and I cut out between meal snacks. I eventually cut out breakfast, and then I cut out lunch. So now I have one meal a day when my kids come home from school, and it works great for me. But in addition to when you eat, you can also improve your lifestyle and your health by changing what you eat. In a nutshell, there are three macronutrients, as your audience probably knows, fat and protein, which are essential. We need those to live. The third one is non-essential. In other words, you don't need these to live, and many human populations live without these. And these are carbohydrates, things like starches and sugars. And as it turns out, the carbohydrates, the unnecessary food group, is also the one that affects metabolism poorly. It raises our insulin. It turns mTOR into an unfavorable position. So the thing I do is I minimize carbohydrate intake. So I avoid sugars and starches, which convert into sugars in your mouth. And then I also happen to avoid seed oils, which are kind of junk industrial oils, which are unhealthy fats that promote inflammation. And then the last one is I avoid grains, not just whole grains, but all grains, because I don't have gluten disease, celiac disease, or gluten allergy. But I believe many experts are now saying that many adults have a low grade inflammatory response to grains and the proteins on the grains, and that drives inflammation. And if that's not enough, most grains in the United States are soaked in a weed killer called glyphosate, which is outlawed by 35 countries around the world for health reasons. So, but those are some of the guidelines. And
yeah. And you mentioned seed oils. What's your opinion on the olive oil? I get a lot of renowned vegan cardiologists saying that's bad for you.
Which one?
The thumbs up? Olive oil.
Olive oil. I'm thumbs up on olive oil. The problem is olive oil oftentimes gets diluted or combined with junk seed oils. In other words, I go to a restaurant and I say, is that olive oil on the salad dressing? Is it olive oil? And they go, oh, absolutely. And I go, hey, can you show me the bottle? And they bring the bottle out, and the bottle says pure olive oil, and it's made with 80% canola oil, which is a junk vegetable oil mixed in with it. And the problem is you really can't tell the difference in the taste with these seed oils. It's not like, you know, sugar. You can tell whether sugar is present or not. But these seed oils, it's not usually not a flavoring effect, but it's just they're put in to save money because seed oils are cheap. They're subsidized by the government with corn subsidies and everything.
Yeah. What about wine, once endorsed by the American Heart Association as being heart healthy? It's recently got a bad rap as being toxic to the body, even in moderation. What's your take on vino?
I've drank alcohol. I appreciate alcohol. I have to say that knowing what I know, the way alcohol is processed by the liver, ethanol is basically a toxin that's processed by the liver, just like fructose, which is a toxin. And they both cause fatty liver disease. They both drive inflammation. They both have a number of untoward effects. So I must say I drink a lot less alcohol than I used to, and I'm really cutting back. There are alcohol-free wines you can take, but my thinking on alcohol has really changed, and I take it very seriously. If I'm going to take fructose and, you know, that seriously, I think I need to, you know, I need to look at alcohol. And people, we all get to choose, but at least understand the risks. And when we make these choices, do them as an informed choice.
Right. I read there's a type of wine that affects the kidneys and makes it harder for older people to urinate. It's called Pinot Noir. Stay away or you're in trouble. You're in trouble. Let's see. Hey, we have to talk last topic. I want to talk about diabetes. It seems more and more people are being categorized as pre-diabetic or having type 2 diabetes, which benefits, of course, big pharma significantly. What are some of the lies we're being told about this common disease?
Well, diabetes was one of the diseases I was diagnosed with, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And it is in astounding numbers. It's an epidemic of it. And fully, according to some studies, half of adults are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. And diabetes, people think, oh, it's just my blood sugar. Well, actually, no, diabetes drives hypertension. It drives heart attacks. It drives cancer. It drives Alzheimer's disease, which is called type 3 diabetes, in fact. So diabetes is something we don't want to have. One realization I had about diabetes that I didn't know before was I used to think diabetes, like a lot of diseases, you either have it or you don't have it. But what I came to understand through some recent studies is if we look at non-diabetic adults, there was a large study that came out recently, and if you look at the marker for diabetes, which is a blood test called hemoglobin A1C, which when it rises above a certain point, then the doctor says, yes, you're a diabetic. And when it's below that point, you're not a diabetic. So when I looked at this study of non-diabetic adults, it showed their hemoglobin A1C levels, and it went higher and higher the older they got. What does that tell me? Well, because the A1C keeps increasing with age, I now view diabetes not as something that, you know, a few people get, well, half the people get and half the people don't, but it's actually something that's part of aging. In other words, it's like gray hair or wrinkles. In other words, if I live long enough and don't die of something else, I'm at risk for diabetes. So how does that inform my choices now? Well, now I choose a diet. I pay close attention to my diet, which is a metabolically healthy diet, which minimizes my risk of diabetes, minimizes my risk of hypertension, cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, mental illness, and also improves my longevity. And that's the beauty of these lifestyle choices. They work across the board on all these things.
Fantastic information. We got about a minute left. Is there anything else you'd like to share from your book that we didn't cover today?
No, I just think this is a new era in medicine where instead of the doctor just giving me a pill and surgery as a patient, I think as a patient, it's now a new era where I get to take charge of my healthcare. I'm the CEO of my own body. And with lifestyle, it's possible to do that because every morning is a new day. When I wake up, I get to choose what I eat, when I eat, and all the other lifestyle choices. So it's so exciting. And I think it's a great time for patients going forward. Our health is going to change and it's in our hands.
Wow. Great information. Thanks so much for joining us and exposing some eye-opening lies. We've all been told. Great book. Hope everybody gets it. And that book is called Lies I Taught in Medical School, How Conventional Medicine is Making You Sicker and What You Can Do to Save Your Own Life. To get your copy or learn more, go to robertlufkinmd.com. And you can follow Dr. Lufkin on Facebook and Instagram and X on robertlufkinmd. And for my daily health post, be sure and follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. If you heard something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast. Great information. Don't keep it to yourself. You go to togoodhealthradio.com and radiomd.com. And while there, also peruse our podcast library and share these segments with friends and family and coworkers and on social media. As I always say, sharing is caring. Don't keep this information to yourself. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned, stay well, and stay away from those lies.